I'm director of the British Council in Colombia. I'd first of all like to congratulate our colleagues at the MAPFRE Hay Festival for this magnificent event and thank all the other sponsors who help make it possible. The mission of the British Council, I better make sure I get it right, is to build engagement and trust through the exchange of ideas between people worldwide. That's why we're here at the Hay Festival. That's why we're so delighted to be able to support the presence here of the next speaker. He's written extensively on the history of art. He's written extensively on history. He's best known to many millions of people around the world, certainly in the UK and the USA, for his very successful television programs on history. He's developed a very particular interest in the USA of the great communicator Barack Obama. So we have a great communicator to come and talk to you and entertain you and engage you. Now, I say a great communicator, that is, you may notice that his voice is a few octaves lower than normal. And that may be something to do with the number of hours spent in the bar La Habana last night, getting to know Colombian culture. Ladies and gentlemen, Simon Sharma.
Hi. Buenos dias. Buenos dias. Gracias por venir. Es un gran honor estar aquí. The word... You can't hear. Okay. We don't charge extra. It's not working. I will start again. It's better. See how deep it is. Buenos días. Gracias por venir. Gran honor estar aquí. Miscegenation. Miscegenation. The word is humpbacked, ugly, portending magnolias, flames, horsewhips, crumbling porticos. That's Barack Obama in Dreams of My Fathers. So what the United States elected, what they did, was to elect not just the first African-American president, but they elected a bona fide writer. In fact, a writer who also, I think, happens to be an historian, too. All his speeches are studded with historical allusions. Just the other night, the State of the Union address began with a memory of a famous disastrous battle, the Battle of Bull Run, that opened the Civil War. So Barack Obama, like no other president before him, I think, demands or at least invites our attention here because you and I constitute, I hope, a community of the word. We are writers and readers. And his election, we like to think, we writers flattered ourselves, perhaps in vain, that we had in the White House a writer. And it was a victory for eloquence over the inarticulate, and you couldn't get a more fabulous incarnation of the claims of the inarticulate than the 43rd president, George W. Bush. So we got a little too happy about this, I think, when George Bush flew away that freezing morning in January last year. It was a sort of farewell to, oh gosh, shucks, in the midst of an incredible multiple maelstrom. We were perhaps a little premature in our complacency about what that meant. We loved Obama, and I think he's loved all over the world, really, because of the beauty and the eloquence. That passage I recited from Dreams of My Fathers is not just constituted of words, it is about the nature of that particular word. Here's a man who pays attention to the sound, the cadence, the rhythm of words. Miscegenation, humpbacked, ugly. I remember when he... on the night I was there, the night he won the caucus in Des Moines, Iowa, the beginning of what was to be an extraordinary campaign, he was certainly not tipped to win that caucus out there on January the 3rd, 2008. He came onto the stage, and that evening was extraordinary. There was no security whatsoever. Thousands of people were coming to this concrete citadel in downtown Des Moines. There was no security because no one had dreamt that he would be the one who'd be giving a kind of victory celebration. And he obviously had prepared for this, prepared for it in only the way a wordy person can. And he began the speech by saying, he began it in tetrameters, calculated tetrameters. He began it as if you could turn politics into four-foot poetry. They said this day would never come. They said our sights were set too high. He said it exactly like that. You can check it out on YouTube. He let the voice drop at the end. And immediately you had a kind of extraordinary spell, because actually it defined those who were they. They were there out in the media who'd said it was Hillary Clinton who'd anointed Hillary Clinton. And then there was we the people who had been presumed to. We the people who were the victims of the notion that this day could never come, that our sets had been set too high. And in that language, in that cadence, came all sorts of wordiness, the wordiness of the founders of the Republic, those who'd written the Declaration of Independence, the wordiness of the great preaching Baptist churches of Martin Luther King and many Baptist preachers, black Baptist preachers before him, on whose roots Barack Obama, who had not been a Christian until very late in life, drew. The wordiness cast the spell, and he never looked back after that. But, let me tell you, the battle between what is eloquence, it's a battle for authenticity. Is it more authentic eloquence, or is actually the kind of restrained, almost inarticulate suppression of elaborate classical speech making more authentically American? That's a battle that reaches deep into American history. And I want to talk to you today in our community of writers and readers about how this battle is still being played out, the investment in whether or not to speak or not to speak actually is a different way of managing power. We need to do just a little bit of a history lesson. You have all been told there will be an exam later, right, before I let you go. In the beginning was the word, wasn't it? The United States began as an utterance, the first time any such thing had happened. Nations were not born with declamations and proclamations and utterances. They were born from the tribal rights of aristocrats and kings and warriors. The United States thought of itself as different. It was intoxicated with the convictions of the 18th century Enlightenment that to say something that was rational and true was to bring it into being. We the people, the beginning of the Constitution. When in the course of human history, the preamble to the Declaration of Independence. Those who wrote it, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, in their different ways. Thomas Jefferson, the Enlightenment sage of Monticello, both attached to equality while, of course, owning slaves. John Adams, a lawyer, the product of long Calvinist preaching, which he'd half rejected. Both were drunk on the possibility of words, words, words. You could will something, bring it. You could change people's allegiance through the sheer strength of what words could do. That was the conviction. And so it continued for a while in American history. But there was always another tradition which had a completely different view. And it actually was older as well as newer than the tradition of Enlightenment, the Enlightenment classical belief in eloquence. The first part of it was religious, was Protestant religion, really, Protestant religion, particularly in the preaching of the great chapel preachers, outdoor preachers, like of the Methodist Church, like George Whitefield and John Wesley, both of whom had preached in America, the preachers of what was called in America the Great Awakening in the early part of the 18th century. They too believed in words, but the words, of course, were not the words of the mind, they were the words of God. Human reason was simply the weak vessel through which the words of God became translated. Prayer and singing, anthems and praise were the true words. And the Great Awakening taught Americans that to be American was to mistrust too much high classical thinking. Believe instead of the rapture of the heart, the epiphanous vision that would come to you through God's good grace, mistrust eloquence as the work of fashionable men. Added to that came a second tradition later on, the tradition of the immigrant frontier. There was something deeply moving about the generations of immigrants who came to America in their millions and millions in the 19th and 20th century, because one of the first things they did was, of course, to learn English, even while keeping the language and rhythms and semantic weight of their own deep traditions. But it was also the case that out on the frontier, drawing a little on that improbable non-frontiersman, Benjamin Franklin, to be American was to be practical, was to shut up, was to create things, was to take things away, take the forest away and put down a cabin instead. And their sense of democracy was not particularly eloquent, it was homespun. Its gracious personification was Andrew Jackson, who in fact had been a lawyer, a Tennessee lawyer, but turned himself into someone famous for his iron taciturnity, broken by spells of reaching out politically in the language of the people, in the pure vernacular. Andrew Jackson very consciously manipulated what the expectations were of a true American politician. For him, it was someone who understood the farmer, the blacksmith, the village brewer, those kinds of people. So he used vernacular in every possible opportunity. Jackson, while being a formidable person like George W. Bush, portrayed himself as someone with whom you would perhaps want to go to a tavern and have a tankard of beer or something like that. Being an old soldier was very important. Old soldiers were not given to simply ornamental use of words. They only spoke when they had to speak. So the quiet American, the cowboy hero, the John Wayne, the Gary Cooper, who said little and did everything, was welded to the tradition of trust the heart and the eyes and not the reasoning head, and made a case that to be American is to mistrust words even as you know how to play the particular economy of language. Eloquence against the silent. It actually came down to an election. It came down to John Adams' son, John Quincy Adams, who is the essence, really, of a thinking, reasoning Christian intellectual against Jackson. And when Jackson had a chance, Jackson beat him soundly. So Barack Obama, come to hear, how does Obama's own career fit into this long battle between eloquence and the patriotic but inarticulate American tradition? Barack, of course, comes, as the memoir tells us, from an extraordinary sense of investment in the multicultural quality of what it means to be America. Part of him came from Kansas. Those of you who have read the book will know about this. His father came from a village in Kenya. But most important of all, I think, for Barack Obama is that he grew up in Hawaii. I don't know how many of you have been to Hawaii. It's an extraordinary place. It is a kind of microcosm almost of the whole world. It is Polynesian, Asian. There's a small black population. It could not have been easy to be an African-American boy growing up, actually, in a quite posh part of the area just outside Honolulu. But above all, Hawaii is almost, it's sort of America's Sweden, practically. It's sort of invests more in government and in education. There are great philanthropic institutions that pour all their funds into the schooling. It's thought, they think of themselves as a crucible of making talking, thinking, rational Americans. Obama grew up first in that tradition, and then when he was smaller, he had two periods in Hawaii, of course. They were broken by being in Indonesia with his mother after his mother's marriage to his father broke up. And there's a beautiful passage in Dreams of My Father where Barack Obama remembers the kind of hippie mother shaking him awake at 4 o'clock in the morning. He was reluctant to get up so that he could improve his language, his English, his schoolwork, and saying to him when he was sort of dragged out of bed muttering and grumbling, as small children certainly will, "This is no fun for me either, Buster." So Barack Obama's always been part of what's thought of as the aspirational aspect of America. Education into the kind of articulate tradition of American writing and American reasoning was very much part of his idealism. It remains part of his idealism about what you can do with politics and what you can do with power. So he came actually into politics with no apologies whatsoever as a speechmaker. He was really, as we found to our cost, I think, this year, relatively unversed in the rough and tumble of American politics. Barack Obama really never had to run a fierce, rough, crude, vulgar campaign, except for one when he tried to run for Congress in Chicago and actually lost to an incumbent politician who knew all about the kind of toughness, mudslinging aspects of local politics. Obama's notion that he could be transformational, that he could be transracial, he could create a new image of consensus and agreement between Americans, rested on the great speech he gave introducing John Kerry at the Democratic Convention in 2004, where famously he said, "We are not red states, we are not blue states, we are not Democrats, we are not Republicans, we are all Americans." And Americans at that moment, apart from being spellbound, reaching to that heritage of rhetoric, were extraordinarily struck by the notion that somehow you could, in the digital age, in the age of television spin, in an age where power and democracy seem to have been trapped by public relations men, still have a young man giving you a sense of community, working to recreate an American community through words. And Obama knew that he'd sort of he'd done something extraordinary in 2004, and it wasn't very long after, I think just a year later, you began to hear, even as it was assumed that Hillary would be the candidate, you began to hear sounds from people who thought he would be an extraordinary presidential candidate. I should explain as well that what Barack Obama had going for him in the campaign were the use of two kinds of words, the kind of words you're hearing now, the sort of high words of literature and of political literature and even of political philosophy, words that could have come out of Jefferson's mouth. But Barack Obama also understands wired words. He was not, as a friend of mine said, just the first black president, the first BlackBerry president. He understood brilliantly how to manipulate the web, how to raise million upon millions of money at a time, really, when the Republicans, the other side, were still assumed that this was all stuff for teenage kids who might be very enthusiastic one day about responding to an Obama blog or something, but would never actually turn out to vote. And that when you were reached at through wired words, you would not actually be prepared to do the hard work of marching up and down the streets, knocking on doors. But that, of course, is exactly what did happen. I should explain also that in the political power, the surprising return of the wordy, that rhetoric, you'll be amazed to hear, actually. But you'll be amazed to hear, I think, is a deep part of the American educational tradition. And I don't know if that's the case in Colombia or in South America or in Spanish, but because of what I was saying about how many, many millions of people shared the sense that to speak and to write actually in some sense made you a democratic citizen of the United States, rhetoric, the formal art of rhetoric, was actually a required subject in school and in college until the very end of the 19th century. In some states, I think until the First World War, exactly what the history of rhetoric being abandoned was, I'm not exactly sure, but that it was incredibly crucial for some of the most powerful men in the country. Of course, Abraham Lincoln being somebody who Barack Obama admires and, if anything, is obsessed with. People like Lincoln had gone through country school versions of rhetoric. They'd used a textbook by a Scottish priest, a Scottish clergyman called Hugh Blair, which basically did Cicero for ordinary people, went back to the great work De Oratore of Cicero and translated into how we can use exordium, peroration, explanation, so the perfect classical sections of how you make people change their mind, take a position through the spell of words. Obama cleverly understood that there was something to be done about reawakening the spirit of rhetoric inside the American community at the same time that he needed to be web savvy. So it was, really, when the campaign started. And there was a moment when Hillary Clinton, suddenly on the defensive, I think it was in the first television debate, said to Barack Obama, you know, Barack, I think she was thinking of the old American adage that you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose, and she has indeed a very good point about that. But she said, she said, and it was the second television debate, that's right, she needed time to recover. She said, you know, Barack, fine pretty words are one thing, deeds are another. And he shot back, as if he were a speech act philosopher, as we call it in universities, Hillary, words are deeds. And he was indeed thinking then, courtesy of a conversation with his friend, the governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, he was prepared to cite the Declaration of Independence and the Gettysburg Address of Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt standing on the steps, the Capitol steps, on another frozen day in 1933 and saying we have nothing to fear but fear itself. One of the great speeches in American history, written by a Columbia University law professor called Raymond Moley. Those are deeds, he said to Hillary. Those change people's minds. They change what they're prepared to do for America, how they understand their relationship to the larger political community. So it went on. It has to be said that during the election campaign itself, when Barack Obama fought John McCain, John McCain was so kind of eccentrically self-exploding in some of those television programs that Barack Obama was sometimes content to stand back a bit. That hasn't always been a good thing for his own purposes or for America. I remember going to rallies during a campaign in Texas, in San Antonio, in southern Texas, a place famous for being a kind of battlefront in the Mexican-American War that ended in the annexation of Texas. And both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were speaking, separated by about an hour. So, and Barack by then was rock star magnitude, really. And it was indeed, he talked in a sort of an open-air theater that was usually given over to rock concerts. And he was late, bad sign, too much bit like the latest, most, you know, punctuality, contemptuous politician ever, William Jefferson Clinton, who never, ever showed up on time for anything, except the occasional date, I think. Barack came late, and there was music, and there was a visual stuff, and he came in, I can't do that, I'm not cool, and I'm not black. But he had sort of perfect body language, he mastered the stage. And I thought, you haven't won yet, sunshine. You know, you're actually taking things too much for granted. But the audience loved it. It was mostly kids. The audience loved it. But there were sort of signs of complacency and I think the over-management. I thought, you know, your whole appeal is that you came from nowhere. You want to reestablish a direct face-to-face, voice-to-voice community with the Americans. Don't make it a Hollywood number. And then we went on to Hillary's rally, which somebody who I hope was fired from the management team of the campaign had decided to organize at the Alamo, the place really where, not a good sign for American campaign. And Hillary was giving her usual very good speech, detailed speech about healthcare, it was actually about healthcare, when the lights went out, just completely wiped her out. And instead of actually stopping or making a joke about, you know, I'm sorry, my speech has put you all in the dark or something, we could all have written, you know, she just went bashing on, saying, and in the third section of our reform proposals, there'll be special tax cuts with families. It was complete darkness. And it struck me that actually, you know, the way they were, she was absolutely tenacious. The lights went on a bit, but only illuminating the faces of the politicians who are behind her. It struck me that moment that one of the things that explained the kind of language capacity, really, of both of them was, this can't be true, but I'd like to believe it was, what their fathers or mothers, mother in actually Barack Obama's case, said to them when they were very small and started to obviously have interesting and powerful little personalities. And I sort of imagine, really, Barak's mother saying, "Barak, do you know you're the most beautiful, cleverest boy there has ever been in the history of the world?" "Am I, Mummy?" "Yes, you are." And it gave him a kind of magnificently invincible sense that actually through his little and gradually adult eloquence, anything could happen. In Hillary's case, her father probably said, really, something happened. "Hillary, I never, ever, ever want you to give up. I never, ever wanted you to cry." But, you know, and Hillary ran a wonderful campaign, actually, towards the end. It was just too late. Barak had sort of accumulated all the election numbers to make it pretty much impossible to stop. So it was actually a brilliant move, both on his part, to offer the post of Secretary of State, at which everybody agrees, whatever you feel about the Obama administration, that Hillary Clinton's doing a pretty tough and good job. And sort of wonderful that she accepted that role. So the campaign unfolded, and it proceeded, as you know, often sort of uncertainly in television terms. I don't think actually Barack Obama was a particularly good television debater, oddly enough, especially against McCain. It was McCain was so poor that it helped. But these great majestic speeches, which, you know, even when you read them on the page, and or now, of course, you can just hit YouTube or find them on the web, were an extraordinary thing. Hadn't happened really since, I think, the Kennedy campaign and perhaps even Roosevelt's campaign against Herbert Hoover in 1932. The speech, particularly, maybe the best thing still that Barack Obama has ever done, was on March the 18th, 2008, when there was a problem with Jeremiah Wright, incredibly radical left-wing black pastor who'd been Barack Obama's pastor, who'd married him and Michelle, and he was a very interesting, tough, but abrasively militant proponent of America, still saturated in racism and reprehensible behavior. And before this really kind of almost destroyed, a great furor was whipped up in the press. Obama went to Philadelphia to Liberty Hall, always associated with the making and signing of the Constitution, and gave an extraordinary speech explaining anger in the history of religion and slavery. But what was also, and it's still a beautiful and powerful and sophisticated document, you felt, well, he had the ability, like a good professor almost, of explaining difficult, complicated history in terms that people could understand. Before the speech finished, again, a remarkable thing to do, because he actually addressed himself to white rage as well, to the uncomprehending rage that had caused terrible violence and cruelty in the South. So one had this extraordinary sense of an arc of time. When he was elected, finally, there was a speech, of course, on the night of November the 4th. It was probably already in the early hours of November the 5th at Grant Park in Chicago. And Barack Obama said, and I'm paraphrasing now here, and of course paraphrases mutilate the kind of poetic cadence of what he was doing. But he said, to those cynics, again, they who said this day would never come, to those cynics we say, we want you to put your hands on the arc of history so that it may be bent into a better future. It was a fantastic metaphor, really. It's kind of iron bow of a cynical interpretation of what could or could not happen in American history that would be turned as if it was making a wheel into the kind of idealized version of American change which the Obama campaign was all about. So I think it's always going to be impossible to know, really, whether or not, you know, his mastery of the word did have the effect. It certainly didn't do him any harm. The Republicans did think, like Hillary Clinton, that being eloquent, you know, was, notwithstanding George Bush's or shucksiness, really. The moment of George Bush really making American silence a moral disgrace came, and the moment when his government lost all legitimacy was not in the Iraq War. Maybe we all wish it would have been, but it was in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. When, instead of actually going to visit New Orleans, which he did very belatedly, and actually talking to people, as American presidents have to do, they must march amidst the ruins of disaster, George Bush did a flyover in a helicopter or an Air Force One or something, the embodiment of a mistake about what it was to be silent at a time of that much pain and anguish, while people were watching bodies bobbing in the filthy mire and oil-stained slick of the drowning waters of the New Orleans Lagoon. So there was, it's hard to know, but it's certainly the case that the great kind of outpouring of support, unlikely support for Barack Obama, was some sort of response that slogans, the yes we canary of it all, weren't simply empty, that it was a kind of declaration of faith in a way there had been a declaration of faith in the beginning of American history, that you could feel American again by being part of this community of affirmation. And there was a moment a year ago in the absolutely bitter cold of the morning when Barack Obama was inaugurated, January 20th, I think it was, 20th, 21st. I was there. We all had to, there were millions of people, 2 million people there, and some of them couldn't get into the mall. It was sort of slightly messy, but there was no sense of, including my daughter who had a ticket, no sense of fury. I was, because I was in the press corps, I was immediately below the president and the senators on the Capitol steps, and I was actually sandwiched probably between two of Joanna Cole's friends, but the editor, I think it was extraordinary, really. You know, there was the editor of Elle, and I think there was the editor of Mirabelle or something, and then I was the not Elle, you know, right in between. And they were leaning across me, and they were saying, isn't it exciting to be so close to him? I thought, that's great. And they said, and the other one said, yes, John Cusack, at last, you know. Who was just above us. It was a weird speech that Barack gave. I thought, it was a weird speech. It was so downbeat. It was so downbeat. It was as though he had actually switched gears and had said, I know you want applause lines. I know this is a great moment in the hearts of all Americans. But I know you want me to talk about Reverend King, but you know I've talked about him over and over again. There's just too much catastrophe going on. The subtext was, I would like to make you all feel good, but you should see the in-tray on my desk. So I'm not going to do it. It was a strange speech. And it was absolutely packed with history, but it was all history of a kind of melancholy kind. There was a point to that. I thought the enemy, the great line was from the Bible, was from the New Testament, let us put away childish things. I thought at that moment the enemy of what Obama was trying to propose, he was making a case for American seriousness. It's all right, actually, to face the magnitude of a catastrophe. And I thought the enemy was Ronald Reagan, actually, whom he will invoke. I mean, just invoked in the State of the Union speech. Not in an ideological sense, but Reagan simply also working with words, saying it is mourning in America and making it be so. The insufficiently grounded causes for smiley face optimism was what Barack Obama was determined in an almost perverse way to dispel, a sort of sense, actually, that if you were a true historian, you were what we call in America a party pooper. And he has a point. He has a point. How is history born in our tradition, ladies and gentlemen, all of ours, with Thucydides in particular? The great virtue and honor and strength of history is that it never comes, it should never come to console or cheer, or indulge in idle national or ideological self-congratulation. The point of Thucydides' great Peloponnesian War was to chastise those who'd led the Athenian democracy into catastrophe in the expedition to Syracuse, Good historians are gadflies. We sting and hurt and are an incredible bloody nuisance to those in power. And we do not indulge in idle cheeriness, really. So the moments when Obama was at his most spellbinding eloquent on the inauguration day were a series of pictures, really, that he drew of Americans in adversity. Slaves enduring the terrible cruelty of the plantation, of course, but also immigrants enduring the filth and poverty and sickness of the steerage boats in order to get to America, frontiersmen freezing in great destitution and squalor out in some miserable part of the Dakotan Badlands. It's all right, he said. That's what it means to be American, too. It is just not about cornflakes and Twinkie bars and chocolate and Pollyanna. It is also about gutting it out. And he ended the speech, do you all remember? He ended the speech with Washington looking at the frozen waters of the Delaware River. So almost in a 19th century painting, that great stone jaw of silent George Washington, not always silent, silent George Washington, believing in the midst of almost inconceivable difficulty that nonetheless the cause would flourish and go on. So there was a sense, really, I asked people as we all trudged back to the subway stations trying to shake the frostbite out of our fingers and noses. I asked some kids and some grannies, you know, how they felt about the speech. They all loved it. They all loved it. Only one or two of them said, oh, if only we could have cheered a little. What he consciously suppressed was that great tradition inside the black churches where you throw something out to the audience and back comes amen. Amen. He wouldn't do that. He wouldn't do that. He was too philosophically lofty. He was grand. And then he started governing in the same spirit, didn't he? It's not true to say that the words of Obama's government mean that nothing has been done. God knows the economic stimulus package may have its critics, including me, but without it, the American economy would be not just down the toilet, but flushed far out to sea. All sorts of things. There was something, you know, if you say it, it's boring, but a law passed against credit card abuse. Now, you know, does that sound boring? But it actually affects all of our pockets. It's a fine print. Yeah. Where credit card companies can charge you 18 to 30%. That's no longer possible. It's no longer legal. All sorts of things actually have been done. But the sense of Obama not wanting to lower himself to actually explain things more directly and simply to the American people who were frightened and out of work cost him very dearly. There were great speeches, weren't there, ladies and gentlemen, during that first year. But where were they given? In Oslo. Fantastic speech. The lightning history of the theory of the just war. Cairo, an amazing speech that maybe not permanently changed the relationship between the Muslim world and the United States, but sure, shifted it for a while. A speech that honored the part, surprise, surprise, that education had in the great Islamic tradition, in medieval universities, the translation and recovery of the great Greek and Greek classics. So speeches were given elsewhere. I was there at Omaha Beach on the 65th anniversary of D-Day, when Obama gave an absolutely extraordinary speech, again saying that all of those who, anyone who has lost a child in war will hate war forever, but there sometimes are wars that must be fought. He was priming himself up to make the case for better or worse for Afghanistan. They were great speeches, but they weren't speeches really made to the American people. Sure, Barack Obama goes on television and gives radio talks every week, but they are kind of factory-made speeches, probably by the very good little factory of his speechwriters, headed by a man called Jon Favreau. It's the case that he, of course, like presidents before him, has speechwriters, but there's good, strong evidence that he, you know, passes them not only, you know, he has a huge amount of input, actually. He writes whole paragraphs, they come back to him, he rewrites. He's more genuine the author of his own speeches than anyone probably since Jack Kennedy or Franklin Roosevelt. But there was a long passage of time when Obama felt that to be president was indeed to make government more decently American. People needn't be ashamed of government by doing good things. And what he neglected was the one thing we all thought he had absolute mastery of, the American story. the American story, people did need, if they needed to have a little bit more cheering and a little bit of celebration on Inauguration Day, wow, they needed to have a little bit more, you know, material for belief and hope and strength and a tiny bit of optimism as the times just got blacker and blacker and harder and harder. And Obama needed to do what he's done this week and then the last week is to, you know, make sure that the government was positioned, as Roosevelt had done, as the protector of the people, not the protector of Wall Street. Franklin Roosevelt had done, if you read the speech that Roosevelt gave on Inauguration Day in March, it was in March in those days, 1933, and then again in 1936, they are incendiary speeches. No American politician could get away with it. Well, I mean, thought of some Yankee version of Trotsky these days. Roosevelt said in the speech from 1936, "I hear that the financial community is united in its hatred of me, and I welcome their hatred." Obama doesn't do hating in that way, and in the, you know, I mean, good for him and not so good for him. Because one misunderstanding, I think, not having gone through the kind of gladiatorial mosh pit roughness of American politics, one misunderstanding I think he's had up until right now, where he's changed his tune a bit, is the notion that, again, you can be the Jefferson end of the American word culture without mastering the Andrew Jackson, tough, barroom end of American politics. It would be nice if American politics, or maybe your politics in Colombia, was all decided on matters of high principle and the legitimacy and excellence of your administration, but it is not. Politics is a filthy, bloody wrestling match, and the people out there want the smell of torn muscle, gristle, and the stains of blood. They love it as much as they loved it in Greece and Rome. Barack Obama does basketball, not boxing. You know, that's in his elegant, elegant way. I'm not saying he should be a kind of cynical. But you know, there were a lot of American presidents on the progressive side who came, understood the principle of demagogic thuggery when it was occasionally necessary. Jack Kennedy came from a family of spectacular Oscar-winning thugs politically, and I was an admirer of him. Lyndon Johnson knew about power the hard way. He spoke very beautifully, actually, some of the greatest speeches ever read or written we forget because we remember Kennedy's were spoken by Johnson, written by Richard Goodwin, and sometimes by him as well. It's not that, so in some sense, the president off in the White House with a kind of peg on his nose, letting other people do the dirty work for him, he lost control of the narrative because there were crazy people out there, and still are, I'm bound to define all those who disagree with my view of American politics as by definition crazy, aren't I, and on the hard right, but there was a great period during the summer when, in fact, the feverishness, the sheer adrenaline pump of feverish ranting on the right took over, in particular, the sense that government was all bad for you. Government, an act of government, actually prevented high street retail banks from closing their doors, wiping out the pensions and savings and deposits of hundreds of millions of Americans. But all government is bad for you. The reform of the healthcare service was some sort of socialist plot to turn America into a red republic. And Obama was just simply too grand. He was too eloquent. He was too philosophically magisterial. He was too gone into the details of his intray to kind of respond in kind until this week. It was very important, the State of the Union speech, which I had to abandon the gorgeous, frolic and intellectual spectacle that we've been enjoying here to go to my hotel room or watch that speech. But I'm very glad I did because a lot rode on the State of the Union speech. I don't know how many of you had a chance. And try and get it, if you can, the Spanish version on video because the body language thing with Obama, as always, is quite important. And it was a different Obama. I mean, I was so... It began with a complicated analysis of what could be done, problems of the deficit, and what would be done about the economy, a slightly sort of not very credible boast about. I mean, he may be right that the worst of the recession is over, but, you know, try telling that to in places like Detroit, where there's 40% unemployment of young black men. Doesn't, you know, that I thought, uh-oh, this is not going right. And then really, he switched tack and he took, for the first time in a very long time, a very simple, first of all, he looked not like a man who was defensive or stricken or panicky about his own politics or about American politics. And he spoke extremely simply, very jokily. He gave a kind of lecture to his own party, the Democrats, who are kind of running away from the government and the president as if it's going to cost them their seat, as it cost the appallingly bad candidate Martha Coakley in Massachusetts, and said, do not run for the hills. Do not run for the hills. It could be straight out of the Andrew Jackson playbook. Then he lectured the Republicans, saying, fine, if you now we've lost our supermajority, if you want to filibuster, use words in order to block action, that's what a filibuster is, you talk legislation to death. If you want to word the government that the American people need, you are going to be held accountable. I thought, yes, at last, pin the blame. Let me set the record straight, he said, for those who were saying, Obama has brought you a deficit of trillion upon trillion of debt. He said, before I walk through the door of the White House, a $200 million surplus bequeathed to America by Clinton had been changed into a $1 trillion deficit by a war we need not have fought in Iraq. Yes. Yes. And then he said, Andrew Jackson, stage two, to everybody. Three words. Pure Andrew Jackson. Four words. I do language, not mathematics. I will not quit. I will not quit. Not Jefferson, not Cicero, not John Quincy Adams. I will not quit. You know, I think actually, it may not work. He may have left it too late. But he did kind of reclaim a sense of command at that point at the end of his speech. We Americans do not quit. Times are hard. He turned what the most impossible task, ladies and gentlemen, is that Americans, the L word is horrible, as in limits, whether it's the size of a hamburger or the notion of economic growth. Don't really want to hear about limits. So he was always going to be on a hard, it was always going to be a rough thing to try and manage lowered expectations. But he turned that issue of actually dealing with adversity, trying to adjust to a new economic world in a kind of honest way. And then he went on Friday, which I've not seen, and it's apparently an even more extraordinary piece of political theater. He said he'd already arranged to meet with the opposition, with the Republicans, and rather wonderfully in the State of the Union. He looked at them and said, Friday I'm going down to meet with all the House Republicans. Looked at them and smiled adorably, that gazillion-dollar flashing dental work smile that Barrett turns on, and says, I bet you can't wait for that. It was very good. It was very good. But it turned into an extraordinary thing. It was televised. Both parties, the president and the Republicans, more surprisingly, agreed to have it televised. And it was rather like the British House of Commons Prime Minister's Question Time. It was a back and forth between the president and his Republican enemies. And it did sort of make the case that another kind of play of words, the play of words of unscripted debate and honest debate and argument, could actually take the need of America forward. So if you're kind of the president of language, if you're a great writer, if you're a thoughtful historian, if finally you've figured out really how to talk to the people simply, if finally you've figured out, you know, how to actually make the government the protector of the people against the banking interests rather than their patsy, it's possible that si podemos, yes we can, need not be a lie after all. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Now we have the fun bit, the questions. So I need my... Okay. I'm happy to take questions, providing they're all easy. Somebody, yes, lady here.
Gracias. Hace poco leí la diferencia entre Barack Obama y Michelle cuando ella tiene una historia de familias, de sus familiares esclavos y él no, porque su padre nunca fue esclavo ni su familia, digamos, negra fue esclava. ¿Qué significa? O sea, me parece muy interesante ese dato. ¿Qué significa para usted?
You all heard the question, right? Wonderful question. I don't think he was such a calculating political enemy as to choose. In fact, we know he wasn't. He fell in love with her in the law firm. But you're absolutely right. Michelle Robinson and the Robinsons come from a family from South Chicago. And it meant that in the constituency of the African American world, particularly, the family that they've made together, the marriage, meant really that the Barack Obama, who was president of the Harvard Law Review, as you say, who didn't really have the history of slavery in his veins, could understand and be part of the world of that memory of historical cruelty. And it's one thing to sort of lecture about it and to read the work of Martin Luther King. It's another thing, actually, to be absolutely inside a family. It's not all just slavery, of course. The African-American community of South Chicago comes from internal immigrants in the United States who, during the terrible so-called Jim Crow years after the Civil War, found themselves, if notionally free as slaves, still incredibly impoverished and destitute, and after 1876 actually cut out by violence from the vote and moved in their millions, actually, to the cities of the North. There is a wonderful book by my friend Nicholas Lemon called The Great Migration about that. So you're absolutely right. It insulated Barack Obama from being accused of being only technically black, really. He's always made, hence that the very first quotation I read you about miscegenation. He's made rather a wonderful virtue of celebrating his mixed race ancestry. He doesn't pretend to be black, actually. But there are two ways, not just in the kind of personal history that the Robinson family represent, but also in their church. Barack Obama came to the Chicago churches in the 1980s as a community organizer, not because he was a sort of believing Christian then, but because it was in the churches that sickness funds and burial funds and campaigns against asbestos and very bad conditions in poor people's housing, it was in the churches that something could be done. And there are passages in Dreams of My Father that are very eloquent about that. But as a result of being part of that world of the black progressive church, he came to be, by his own account, a believing Christian. So two kinds of grafts onto his own personality were accomplished. And it is very important. You know, we made two films about Obama's first year for the BBC that were aired a couple of weeks ago. And we went to a food bank in South Chicago. Almost one in eight people in American cities is now dependent on some form of food aid. It's absolutely appalling. And we asked people who were receiving food, had they become completely disenchanted with Obama? And we were in Chicago, in his hometown, it's true, but they said, give the president a chance. It's only been 1 year. Other presidencies have not started well. They had absolutely not lost faith. And I think it's because, it is at least because of the person he is and the person Michelle is, actually, that he still retains the loyalty. It's very, very important for his political future, if he's going to be re-elected, or even if he's to retain power in the midterm elections in November that all of those people in the minority communities, Latino as well as black, come out and vote and not sit at home. Ah, there's a lady here. Hi.
I was somewhat appalled to hear him call the bankers fat cats out in public, or to suddenly jump at the case of the professor whose house was taken to jail because the policeman thought that he was breaking into his own house. He seems to have these knee-jerk reactions that kind of boomerang against him, because the media is very quick in picking those up and turning them around. What do you have to say about that?
It's another extremely good question. I didn't take quite the same view as you. Goldman Sachs is not the most popular institution in the United States right now. I think actually the issue that he has made it very clear that he's not some kind of revolutionary, really. You do have to understand that there is a long history of antagonism towards banks that goes back to the founding of the Republic. It goes back again. Sorry to do so much history for you on lovely Sunday morning, but there was a great fierce debate between Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury, who perfectly reasonably loved banks and thought it was ludicrous. America's destiny was to be a great capitalist power, and Jefferson, who talked about stock and securities as, he said, the banks have seduced our people to indulge in forms of gambling, which he meant sort of investment on the early form of the stock exchange in America. I'm not saying that the populist view is right. And the other crucial moment came at the end of the 1800s, in the late 19th century. It's a very obscure, again, problem, but it wasn't seen to be obscure in the country, about whether or not American money should be backed by gold. All of the great bankers, especially J.P. Morgan, who was a complicated and rather heroic figure in my view, actually, felt it was absolutely imperative that the dollar was pinned to the so-called gold standard, because America was ultimately dependent on the import of capital from Britain and Germany and places abroad if it was really to flourish. But the cost of the gold standard was to keep interest rates fairly high so that those who were investing in various forms of securities would get a decent return, otherwise it wasn't going to be worth their while. Those who suffered, the 1890s, again, apologies for the history lesson. Oh, hell, I don't apologize. I'm a professor and you're already paid to see me. What the hell? So listen up, class. The 1890s were a time of terrible economic turmoil, massive unemployment, especially in the countryside. Terrible, people had borrowed money to pay for the new equipment like tractors and early forms of combine harvesters. And then when the bad times came and demand for agricultural goods fell, their loans were called in, they couldn't do it. So a campaign started for bimetallism, there's a sexy word for Sunday morning, to have at least the dollar in two tiers, pegged to gold and pegged to silver. What it basically meant was if you were a small guy, you're a shopkeeper, you're a farmer, if there would be silver-backed dollars, your credit would be much, much easier. And you may have heard, if you've not, you should, a politician called William Jennings Bryan. This lady has, I know. And who was a lay preacher, who was, again, the great figure of late 19th century eloquence, and who made an extraordinary speech in 1896, which changed the Democratic Party from a party of the defeated South, really, into, for the first time, a populist party. He talked about the need for a silverback dollar, but he talked about it, his own party, as needing to embrace the cause of those who could not get credit. He said wonderfully, a small dry goods man is as much a businessman as a great manufacturer. Those who go down 2,000 feet into the bowels of the earth are as much men of money as those who in back rooms hoard the precious metals of the world. When he finished with, "You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." And Jennings Bryan stood back. The audience was completely thunderstruck. "You shall not crucify." And he lifted his arms up in the attitude of the crucified Christ. He was a great preacher. And at that moment, the Democratic Party changed identity, but so did, under Theodore Roosevelt, the Republicans. And Banks became, for better or worse, the great scapegoat of economic misfortune. Now, that said, I was more surprised that Obama didn't go after them sooner. It was not the point at which bankers, that Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and the rest of them really had been the beneficiaries of a huge amount of public money given to them, of course, in so-called TARP under the Bush administration and sustained by Obama. It was when, of course, they started paying out these gigantic bonuses, having been rescued by my income taxes. Sod that, really. So, it did generate a huge amount of public anger. And for me, he's been quite soft-pedaling that possibility. I do agree with you. It doesn't solve things very much to sort of be hysterically demonized. But he's now being quite careful between sorting out good bankers and bad bankers. He did say, "I know you don't like us bailing out the banks. It's as popular as root canal treatment." So you can sort of expect to hear that. He's still very delicate compared to Franklin Roosevelt. Gentleman at the back there.
In the BBC series that you just had played in the UK, you interview a Chicago union leader who says that...
Right.
They always knew about Barack Obama that they would have to have a foot stuck up his backside and kept it there. Do you think that was true? And B, who do you think is doing that if it is true?
We're finishing. So, yes, he's had that happen. The foot up his backside is called Massachusetts. That's an incredibly shocking election. It couldn't have come too soon. Thank you all very much. Gracias a todos. Thank you.